From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we talk about the rise of political and social activism in sports. Then we hear how urban farming has changed in light of the pandemic, at a time when it's needed more than ever.
While we had to limit the number of people and put in safety measures, we really did see that our gardens that we help coordinate can be these places where people come together in positive ways and have their emotional needs met, have their needs met for fresh food.
Plus, this month's Milwaukee Music Roundup features some venerable summer jams.
It's still summer, and there's the perennial, you know, summer music. People always love summer jams. So that's kind of what I'm focusing on this time around for this month's roundup.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. The Milwaukee Bucks shocked some fans on Wednesday when they chose to not take the court for their scheduled playoff game in protest of the shooting of Jacob Blake. Blake was left paralyzed after being shot in the back multiple times by Kenosha police officer Rustin Shesky. The decision by the Bucks was supported by the NBA, which decided to cancel all scheduled playoff games last Wednesday. The Milwaukee Brewers followed suit, deciding to skip their game, and other Major League Baseball teams joined in on the boycott. In some ways, the decision was historic and unprecedented, but it can also be seen as the culmination of a season in sports that has been noticeably and unmistakably political. From Black Lives Matter painted on NBA courts to jerseys that replaced names with things like I Can't Breathe and Enough. UW-Milwaukee Assistant Professor Michael Myrer says there hasn't been a time in sports history as profoundly political as what we're seeing today. He joins me now to talk about sports and activism. Michael Myrer, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Pleasure to be here.
So this might be a kind of vague question to begin with, but I think it kind of sets up the tone of the rest of our conversation. When we think about sports in the U.S., what do you think sports teams really mean to American culture?
You know, I think one of the things that we see just time after time is that sports teams are one of these ways that cities just come to define themselves. And we can go back to sort of the rise of cities. So after the Civil War, Americans start piling into cities. And one of the ways that these local newspapers and these local boosters started to define themselves is through the use of sports teams, the use of the creation of civic pride in sports teams. And so sports teams in the United States have really been these notions of civic pride. I think one of the interesting things about us here, as opposed to, say, Europe, is that our sports system has tended to operate in a local monopoly system. So there really is only one basketball team in a city, right? There's some accidents like Chicago and New York and other places where there are multiples. But really, you know, there's only been one major team per sport in most cities. And so rather than sports being the teams representing different neighborhoods or different aspects, like if you follow English soccer, right, there's different neighborhoods, different parts of London that various teams represent. In the United States, they really have been this sort of citywide institution. And as such, you know, the challenge in sort of maintaining that position for many, many years has really been to try to, you know, sit above politics. And I know that's where we're going. So that's been part of it, is that the idea of keeping politics out of sports has been a really important article of faith for a long time. Because, you know, if you think about, you know, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, right? Democrats and Republicans both read the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, but everybody is assumed to be a Bucks fan. So as long as you keep the politics away, the Bucks, the Brewers, the Packers, you know, it becomes this kind of thing that belongs to everybody.
With that in mind, in some ways, activism has been a part of sports in the United States as long as we've had sports teams. But there's always been complicated views about what that activism should look like and whether or not it's appropriate. When we look back historically, what do we view now as being some of the highlights of sports activism?
Well, I think the highlights of sports activism, you know, I think one of the things that's been interesting in the last couple of days is people talking about these hidden moments of sports activism that I had, you know, that I had never heard of, right? But we do have these major moments, right? You have Muhammad Ali in the 60s. You have John Carlos and Tommy Smith raising their fists at the 1968 Olympics, right? These are these sort of great moments of sort of oppositional activism that really become iconic moments in our culture, right? People hold up that image of the sprinters on the award pedestal holding up their fists is something that we all are familiar with and we all recognize. I think that, you know, at the time being, though, those were not widely accepted positions, right? Those guys were deeply unpopular for making those choices. Muhammad Ali was widely hated for not going to the draft, for not going to Vietnam. So, you know, those I think are the major moments we think about. I guess I'll say there's been a lot of activism in the 60s around issues of segregation, players, basketball teams and college football teams trying to play in the South when the whole team couldn't stay at the same hotels, right? And so that's come up a lot. And then we also have moments of labor activism, which has really been a part of American sports since the mid-60s, where players have started to form unions and push those issues forward, employment issues forward, and bring those to the public, which, of course, is a form of class politics. But what we have in this case is that it's always really unpopular at the time, right? That we look back on it, Muhammad Ali's a beloved figure now, in part because I think most people agree that he was right. Vietnam wasn't a great idea. But at the time, nobody agreed with that, right? At the time, nobody thought it was right that the calls for equal rights for African Americans was a proper position, especially not one to bring into sports.
You know, as you mentioned, some people believe it's inappropriate for sports stars to use their platform to advance social justice causes. And it's a rationale that I personally don't quite understand. Can you unpack that line of thought and where this idea comes from that by virtue of being a professional athlete, you should leave your politics aside?
So I think it goes back to what we started with, is that the idea in the United States is really that sports are a place of unity, right? That athletics are a place that we come together and, you know, doesn't matter what color you are, we all wear the same team logo on our chest, right? And it doesn't matter what race the athletes are, you know, we all root for our home team. And so when athletes choose to speak out, for a long time, I think the view was, well, you're bringing politics into this space that's supposed to be apolitical. Now, there's a bit of ridiculousness to that viewpoint, right? I mean, think about where the teams are playing, right? Professional sports teams play in publicly funded arenas, and the players are, in many cases, trained at public universities to play these various sports, right? Most of the major athletic factory college teams are public universities. And the players come from a variety of backgrounds and their experiences are shaped in certain ways. And so when athletes step up to say, hey, my experience says something is wrong or this is a problem, I think they often are faced with people who say, well, sure, but this is not really the place for it, right? Sports is really where we come to relax, where we come to pull together. And bringing politics into that, making political statements within that, has been seen as sort of creating matter out of place, creating the idea that we're imposing a certain logic into sports that doesn't belong there. Now, of course, you know, I'm a college professor, right? So of course I would say that being apolitical is in fact a political viewpoint. But that's not, you know, that the idea of that that view has not really gained broader purchase, at least not until recently.
So, you know, I feel like we've seen kind of evolving attitudes on the place of activism inside of sports. And this year, we've seen a lot of activism among many leagues, but we're seeing it right now with both basketball and Major League Baseball. Can you talk a bit about what we've seen this year just overall?
I mean, sure. It's been a really incredible couple of months here to watch basketball players. And I think part of it is that normally in the middle of May and June, they would be deep in the playoffs and focusing on who's going to make the finals, who's going to win the championship. We were all off, right? Everything was shut down. Sports was shut down, a rarity in our society to have sports disappear. And so, you know, I think everybody saw the George Floyd video, or at least saw stills, or at least knew what happened. And what's been impressive is just been how willing NBA players have been to put themselves into this protest movement. We're a long way away from the period of time where, you know, the Michael Jordan, you know, Republicans buy sneakers too, which is not to say that Republicans thought what happened to George Floyd was okay. Many of them didn't. But what we see, you know, what we saw is that athletes sought to be apolitical for a long time. And, you know, and it's not like we haven't seen athletes struggle, get in trouble for being political before. But here, in the case of what the NBA players did, is they put themselves on the front lines. They were leading protest movements. They were leading march. You know, the Milwaukee Bucks players were part of a protest march. They stood up and they said, this is wrong and this affects us directly. And what's been interesting is that when the NBA approached them about restarting the season, going down to Orlando, doing it in the bubble, as we say, this was the ability to sort of bring those ideas to the forefront, to speak openly about social justice, to, you know, to put Black Lives Matter on the court, to let people put slogans on their jerseys. That was part of the rationale for the players, right? This situation that they're in, right? They're away from their families. They're locked up in a, you know, in a luxurious area, but it's still they're, you know, they're limited what they can do and who they can see. And so, you know, the idea that they could sort of use this platform was, I think, something that was appealing to them and something we really hadn't seen before. Again, sports tend to strive to be apolitical, to reach the largest possible audience. And the deal the players struck to go down to Orlando was, well, you're going to have to embrace these viewpoints. You're going to have to let us speak out. And so that's how it started. That's what the players did. And that was really, really impressive and really unusual in the grand scheme of how sports tend to work.
It does seem like such a peculiar year. I mean, for so many reasons, as I'm sure everyone would agree, we've seen a lot of different ways that the NBA in particular, but also other leagues, have, you know, put these messages out there. You mentioned, of course, things on the court, things on their jerseys that say, you know, Black Lives Matter, that speak to this fight for racial equity and justice. It did feel like, though, the move to cancel games was a new step, was a bigger step in some ways. What do you think the impact of actually just canceling these games, what do you think the impact of that was?
So I think when we think about sort of social movements and the push to sort of put ideas on the public agenda, you know, athletes, when they do speak out, are really effective at that because their workplaces are full of cameras, right? So most protest groups really struggle to get media attention and athletes don't. And so when they went down there, part of it was getting media attention for their cause. But I think they rightly, you know, deduced that in some ways that it all faded into the woodwork, right? That, you know, after 3.5 weeks of watching games on courts that say Black Lives Matter, people stopped noticing, right? That the idea of there being a problem with policing in this country becomes sort of no longer as top of mind, right? It sort of fades into the woodwork. And so after the shooting of Jacob Blake, and especially for the Milwaukee Bucks, who, you know, Kenosha is not that far from where they play, I think this next action, some call it a boycott, it's actually more of a strike, although they might not want to use that term because they're actually not allowed to strike based on their collective bargaining agreement. Part of what happens is that it propels this back into public view again, right? It forces people to connect back to that original message, right? That there are problems that need to be addressed and that the problems are not being addressed. So the move to cancel games and in the way they did it too, which is basically not telling anybody and deciding to do it just at the last moment, right before tip off, they didn't come out for warmups before the game. That again was a way of attracting attention to the reason that they were there in the first place. And so that move is something that's really, it's a really good way to try to bring attention back to your original message. And so that's what I think was really unusual and interesting about what happened on Wednesday.
Yeah. Now, there are some on the right, specifically conservatives, who are saying they'll never watch basketball again. They have said similar things about football when we saw more political activism among football players. How do these kinds of counter-movements impact the world of sports, and do we see this having a lasting and possibly negative impact?
You know, I think there probably are people who will walk away. You know, I think ultimately if you're a person who views their party affiliation as stronger than their team affiliation, then you're probably not a person who was already a major customer for those teams, right? So in that regard, potentially, that's maybe not a huge deal. The idea of sports becoming sort of politics by other means, I think, does raise a lot of very interesting questions about the implications for sports, right? We have Fiserv Forum, right? This beautiful arena that's downtown that was supposed to host the Democratic Convention and that, you know, took a lot of public money. If sports are more partisan, become more of a partisan political object, are they still going to be able to command public money? You know, if something like the Super Bowl stops being the mass audience event, that changes the entire sports landscape and media system, right? So we do have these questions, right? As politics get imposed onto sports, as people start to sort of articulate these connections, I think we do see some very interesting implications. I think ultimately, you know, the people who are willing to walk away from this over this, you know, the basketball players have been doing this for 3 months, right? If this was the last straw, they probably weren't paying that close of attention to begin with.
Well, Michael Myrer, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Great. My pleasure.
Michael Myrer is a visiting assistant professor at UW-Milwaukee in the Department of Journalism, Advertising, and Media Studies. After the break, we'll learn how urban farming has changed in light of the pandemic. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The COVID-19 pandemic caused millions of people to lose their jobs, and many are facing economic hardship. For some families, it's been challenging to access fresh food. One of the organizations trying to help is called Groundwork Milwaukee. Growing and sharing produce is what they do. But like many other things, the work has had to change since the pandemic began. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz visited Groundworks Urban Farm in Glendale, where tens of thousands of pounds of produce are grown for the community.
I'm Damian DeBoer. I'm the Deputy Director of Programs and Operations for Groundwork Milwaukee. I've been serving in this role for the past year and a half. I get to really support our team as we figure out how to distribute food in the community, create opportunities for fresh water and water access, and then also to work with young people and making sure that they're getting the education and understanding kind of the work that we're doing, so that as we transition out of these roles, young people can kind of take over and they've got the foundation to do the work.
So talk about this place.
Today we're out at the Malio Farm, which with partnership with the River West Food Pantry. Groundwork Milwaukee has been partnering with the River West Food Pantry for the last 3 years out here. Previously, Will Allen Growing Power had come in and they put up all of these hoop houses that you see. We have 11 of them. And through the work that we're able to do out here, we're able to provide, last year was 13,000 pounds of food to shoppers at the River West Food Pantry. This year we're working on some things where a good amount of the produce still continues to go to the River West Food Pantry. And then we're working on distributing that food in the other communities that we work in. So we work throughout the city of Milwaukee. So currently we're working with New Beginnings Are Possible, which is on the northwest side, helping them with their food pantry and supplying fresh produce for that. And we're also working with Tikkun Ha'ir and their efforts to create meals for people with the fresh produce that we grow out here.
Does the vision, has it always involved getting the food to the people who have the least opportunity to enjoy fresh food?
Yeah, this farm has always been focused on getting fresh food to those who are at most need for having it. I'd say what we've really looked at as we continue to become more entrenched in food systems locally and in Milwaukee, what we've really looked at is our role can be one of the supply side. You know, we've got this farm out here, we've got gardens throughout the city of Milwaukee, about 100 that we operate within our network. And so we look at how do we take the excess produce from that, take excess produce from gardeners who aren't in community through our Fresh Fruit Connect app, and linking those folks with excess to the folks who are in need. So we've really focused on that this year, trying not to worry as much about the demand side, because there are so many organizations out there who are getting food out to people, and that's we want to make sure that we're maximizing what we can bring to the table and not duplicating services. Next year, what we're really looking at is how do we expand the produce that's grown locally in those 100 gardens that we support throughout the city of Milwaukee, so that we can even make the food system more hyper-local and folks can go to their neighborhood community garden to pick up fresh tomatoes, to pick up, you know, the zucchini that's out there and to use that to nourish their families instead of having to use gas or time or other resources to get out to grocery stores and other food distribution places.
Tell me a little bit about those other, an idea of what those other 100 gardens are. Are they small neighborhood little pocket places?
Yeah, our gardens range from being small neighborhoods gardens to city blocks of farmers who grow produce for farmers markets and so on. So we've got a wide array of gardens that we support in the Milwaukee area, and those are all run by volunteer garden leaders. We do have 5 gardens that we also operate.
What was the vision of the season, of what you'd be doing as this growing season approached?
Yeah, this year, I mean, typically like last year, we really brought in a lot of groups from employers and other community groups to help volunteer. The farm is mainly run by volunteers, and we really rely on their support to get the thousands of pounds of food out. You know, we still had that same plan going on this year, and with COVID, we had to adjust to really focus on individuals, being really mindful about our volunteer process and who can be out here, when they can be out here, and thinking about safety. That's definitely our number one priority when it comes to our volunteers and when it comes to our service.
My name is Samson Stroke, and I'm the food system specialist for Groundwork Milwaukee.
Tell me who you have working with you this morning.
So part of my job is volunteer coordination for Groundwork Milwaukee, specifically at the Malio Farm. So at the farm this morning, we have a fantastic group, around 15 people, one of which is a volunteer group from a Rotaract club, and the rest of these folks are just individually committed. Actually, usually tend to come like twice a week or so.
How long have you been with the group?
I just started with Groundwork Milwaukee at the beginning of June.
Oh my gosh.
It's a funky time to jump into everything. Things are planted, a lot of volunteer coordination has been done, you're kind of received what you're given. But the folks who I interact with, both gardeners, volunteers, co-workers, come from such a place of genuine passion and love for this work of food security and land sovereignty. So it's an amazing team to be thrown right into. At this part of the season, we're growing around 300 pounds of produce at a minimum every week, which feels cool. That feels awesome.
And exhausting.
Oh, yes, very.
And then I know there's like 100 gardens, some big, some little pockets. Are you literally physically involved with those?
I'm sort of on backup for any support that they might need. Like on Saturdays after the workday, I might get a text asking for support, but I'm generally in this location.
Damien got into this a bit, but what is the process? In other words, in those 100 gardens, families have plots and they're harvesting their goodies. And then is the excess, is that what Groundwork picks up and gets out to people who would enjoy it?
Yeah, that's our goal.
Okay.
And we do that for some gardens. We have a program that I lead that's the other half of my job for food systems. Right now I lead Fresh Food Connect, which is a mobile app that any gardener can download and offer their produce for donation. So they just list what they have available, and then one of our couriers comes by and picks it up. This is our first year. This is actually the end of our first month launching the app. So yeah, definitely. It's pretty small right now. We're just picking up for River West, Shorewood, Bayview, and quite a few zip codes in Wauwatosa.
And couriers, meaning these are volunteers, I take it?
Yes, yeah. Just a volunteer who has a bike or a car and wants to grab some veggies.
So how has it been, Samson, in terms of volunteers? And again, I know this is unusual because this is your first season here, and it's an unusual season. So how do you navigate that?
For safety at the farm, we're always wearing masks anytime we're less than 6 feet away from each other. Then anytime that we're in the hoop houses, which are these huge raised beds with plastic covering over the top. Great for the plants, in terms, but not great for air circulation. So then we're always making sure to bleach tools, hand tools, before we put them back in the bucket or pass them to each other. And we encourage folks to wash their hands if they're not wearing gloves, or especially before we harvest, we like really take a moment to check in with our COVID safety. And folks are fantastic about the rules in this space. A comment that I get from folks when they're signing up to volunteer, when we do like a virtual orientation to go over COVID safety, is saying that they're looking for this opportunity, like, in a way that's related to COVID, that it's just a time to give back to the community, just having more free time and the ability to be out there, you know, sort of sad. It's a very COVID-aware space. Folks are fantastic about following the rules.
So how do you think this season will influence the next?
The biggest change is instead of being able to rely on huge volunteer groups, like a company workday, getting 20 people out here at a time, which I've heard is the majority of our labor in previous years, there's this new need to just engage with folks on the individual level. And we never have more than 15 people out here at the time, so that individual connection is really important, which as a volunteer coordinator, I authentically really love doing. And I would hope for next year to have that formalized a little more, have maybe a more formal like apprenticeship sort of internship program for folks that are committed to this sort of work, and in that be able to provide like classes and just like more connection to the work as a whole.
I'm just going to ask you to share lessons, silver linings.
I think our lessons and silver linings this year were kind of the same thing in a lot of ways. Our work is hyper-local. We're trying to help neighbors in their communities build green spaces that meet the needs that they have. So through food, through recreation, having safe spaces where people can congregate, you know, we definitely weren't able to engage the spaces that, like, in the way that we wanted to earlier in the year. We were really hoping, like, in our community gardens, that we'd be able to have more events. And while we weren't able to get that type of engagement, what we did see was a real thirst for people being able to engage outdoors. So while we had to limit, you know, the number of people and put in safety measures, we really did see that our gardens that we help coordinate can be these places where people come together in positive ways and have their emotional needs met, have their needs met for fresh food, and all of that. So what that really brings us to is kind of an affirmation to what we do and what we already had a plan for, and really looking for next year and for years to come to build up our community gardens as places where people can congregate even more so, to get those emotional and social needs met, along with having fresh food available for them to eat.
So when you look beyond groundwork, what does urban ag look like now? Is COVID sort of assisted in that movement, or is it held it back?
I think we're seeing people wanting to take more control over the food that they eat. And through that, what ended up happening and what has and continues to happen is you see a real demand for information for seeds. I mean, like, seeds were selling out. Right now, you've got a situation where, like, canning jars are selling out. I think people are really connected to this idea of being able to have control over their food system a little bit more. So what we've seen is a huge demand for even our support of gardens that aren't in our network. We've seen a huge demand for information on how folks can best set up their gardens, and a demand for people who want to share the harvest that they've been able to grow. So I think overall we've seen a way more interest in urban agriculture, whether it's on a big scale like here at the farm or in our community gardens or even in folks' backyards.
What do you think is important for people at large, people who either do or don't think about accessibility to good food?
I think what's important is it's not, maybe you don't think about fresh food, you know, access and how important that is, but everyone here and everyone can remember times where they were around the table with their family eating food. And congregating and enjoying each other's companies and feeling nourished spiritually, emotionally, and through food. I think what we're really trying to do is build that sense of belonging, and that sense of belonging, and want to make sure everyone who comes here, anyone who's engaged in our gardens, has that sense of belonging, either with the community that they're working with, and like right in front of them, or with the community who's going to benefit from the produce that we're helping out here. So I think at Groundwork, we really feel that food can help promote a sense of belonging, which we so desperately need in the city of Milwaukee. And we're really, really proud to be a part of that.
Damian DeBoer is the Deputy Director of Programs and Operations for Groundwork Milwaukee. Samson Sirok is a volunteer and food systems specialist for Groundwork Milwaukee. They spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz. After a short break, we'll have the latest Milwaukee Music Roundup with Milwaukee Records' Matt Wild. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. Continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. As we all muddle through the dog days of summer, it can be refreshing to have a good summer playlist. And although most live shows have been put on hold because of the pandemic, Milwaukee musicians are continuing to make music, and as always, Matt Wild has been listening. Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record, which describes itself as an online source for music, culture, and gentle sarcasm. Among the many cultural things Milwaukee Record keeps track of is a nearly exhaustive list of new music from local musicians. Wild is the curator of that list, and he joins me every month to share with us a sample of what he's been listening to for the Milwaukee Music Roundup. Matt Wild, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me back. It's always a pleasure.
So as the pandemic has been continuing and, you know, things have been crazier than ever, I'm interested to know how that's been reflected in music. Are you seeing new trends in music at all?
Well, I think at the beginning of the pandemic, of course, we saw a lot of new music coming out that directly addressed the pandemic, either, you know, thematically or just the fact that it was being made in quarantine. And that's kind of tapered off a little bit. And now, certainly, there's a lot of social justice music being put out there as well. And that's really been at the forefront for the last couple of months. And it's all just kind of this crazy, heady mix of all of that sort of stuff. And on top of that, you know, it's been summer. It's still summer. And there's the perennial, you know, summer music. People always love summer jams. So that's kind of what I'm focusing on this time around for this month's roundup. Just kind of late summer, lazy summer jams. Something to chill out to on the dog days of summer, as it were.
So for people who are trying to get their heads out of the news a little bit, this is a good place to start.
I think so, absolutely. Yeah. Take a break just for a few minutes at a time, and sometimes that's all you need.
So let's dig into this list of musicians and list of songs. Tell us a bit about this first artist, Nile.
First artist we're going to be talking about, yes, is Nile. Now, he is part of a kind of a hip-hop collective, I suppose you would say, called the Fat Nerds, which is a great name for a hip-hop collective. They do a lot of stuff, and he's kind of splintered off and done his own thing for a new EP that he just put out called Forest of Giant. Kind of a brief 5-track EP. Not his first, I guess. He's put out a couple, I believe, last year. So he's always very, very busy. And as I was talking about before, kind of these late summer jams to kind of chill out to, this, I think, is... this entire EP really falls in that realm. It's a very interesting mix, and especially the song we're going to be listening to, which is called Internet Go. It's this strange mix of these kind of very serene instrumental backing, and then in the case of this song, this kind of very, like, energetic kind of like go, go, go kind of chanting. And before he gets to, you know, his lyrics, he has a really kind of interesting flow. And I just love the juxtaposition between this very energetic vocal paired with this, like I said, very serene, very summer-esque backing. So I would definitely recommend checking out this entire EP. It's called Forest of Giant. He just put it out. So yeah, this is Nile with Internet Go.
And just a note for our listeners, we're actually going to be starting this song partway through, in part because there's a little bit of adult language that we shouldn't air. Go, 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 go. I trip when I trip, I trip when I trip, I trip when I trip, I trip when I go.
I trip when I trip. What's the cost paying for it? All the negatives can get ignored. If you work your heart, you get endorsed. That's facts. Yeah, they be down since I found my sound. Feelings are whole. Been taking my time. I see the signs. Speak to my soul. I've been a book, shot my area code. Gotta stay down for the come up. I know change is coming. You just gotta stay focused. Watch them rise when the sun up. Reaching for the comments. Yeah, dreams like old blood. Reduce the power, take control. Watch them self-destruct and make them fold. Really desensitized to me the most. Even when my back's against the wall, still I get my y'all when I go, go, go.
That was Internet Go by Nile. So this next group, I like the name. It's very playful. Daydream Retrievers.
Daydream Retrievers, yes, and it, I have to catch myself every time I say the name or even type the name because I just want to instantly type out Daydream Believers, and because, you know, who doesn't love the Monkees? And yes, so Daydream Retrievers is, it's almost a solo project by a local musician and producer. His name is Ian Alvera, and he put out a self-titled album under the Daydream Retrievers name a couple of years ago. And now he's back a couple of years later with this new song, which is called Static on TV. And this time around, he's joined by a host of Milwaukee kind of music ringers. I remember when Ian reached out to me about this song and he said, you know, is this the right time for a chipper kind of power poppy guitar song, which is very much what this is. To which, you know, I just kind of informally said, there's never a bad time for this kind of song and this kind of music. And I think he does it so well. It is such a catchy little tune. I think for anyone who's fans of just kind of power pop in general, it reminds me a lot of like 90s groups like Apples and Stereo. So yeah, this is the newest single from Daydream Retrievers. It's called Static on TV.
Static on TV by Daydream Retrievers. The next artist we're going to hear from is the name Desi or Desi?
Desi, I believe. She's actually a pretty new to me. She just reached out to me a couple of weeks ago, and I had seen her name around town a little bit. She's been in the process of unveiling some songs for a kind of upcoming EP. The name of her EP called Space in Between, and I think it's just a 3 or 4 song EP. And when she reached out to me with this, I was really intrigued because, again, it was this very lovely, very soothing. So the song that we're going to be listening to is Stay Up, and she describes it as, she says, Stay Up was inspired by my need to honor my inner child, that fearless creativity that kids have because there's just something inside of them and they need to get it out. And she has an accompanying video for this, which I would really suggest everyone check out. It's a lovely animated video that goes so well with this song and vibe. And I just really love this song. It's just such a wonderfully produced and delivered song. It's very short, and all of her songs are very, very short. Some under, like, you know, 2 minutes, which I think is an interesting choice. So, again, just if you need to get a break just for a couple minutes, you could do a lot worse than this. So this is Desi with Stay Up.
Mm-hmm.
Desi. Now, this next song title, it feels very timely, but I also think to myself, maybe it's always timely. The song is called No One Should Hate.
No One Should Hate by local band The Quills. And it's funny you mentioned that it's kind of this, obviously this should be a timeless message. The Quills, I believe according to them, they wrote this song something like 2 or 3 years ago. So it's kind of an older song, but I think they were inspired by events of 2020 to finally kind of record it and put it out now. So it is a duo made up of Becky Heck and Sage Schwarm. Folks in Milwaukee probably know them as the owners of the Bayview shop Love Unlimited, kind of a retro kind of fashion place that's been around for a long time, I think since the early 2000s. They recently, this summer in July, I believe, had a fire at their store and had a lot of damage. And so they've had a pretty rough year. But they've been still putting out music under The Quills. And I've always really enjoyed their music. It's this very stately, very new wave and synthy, but this very stately and restrained kind of sound. Sage, folks may also know him from Milwaukee's Codebreaker, which was a huge band in the early aughts, and share some of the same DNA with The Quills. So, like I said, I really like this song. I really like that it was the song that they kind of had lying around that they hadn't recorded yet, but felt compelled to record it right now. So it's The Quills with No One Should Hate.
No One Should Hate by The Quills. Now, this playlist has been very much, you know, songs for the summer. But, of course, we're getting into fall right now. What are you looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to going to CVS and buying all the Halloween junk that I can possibly afford and just filling my apartment with just the cheesiest Halloween junk. It's my favorite time of the year. I begin celebrating Halloween in about a day or two. So I'm ready for the 2-month-long celebration. So I love summer. I'm sad to see it go, but I'm one of those Halloween nerds that really nerds out. So that's what I'll be up to for the next 2 months. So when I talk to you next time, expect a lot of spooky Halloween-themed songs. So I can't wait.
All right. Sounds good. Well, Matt Wilde, thank you so much for joining us once again here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
Matt Wilde is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record. Every month he publishes his Milwaukee Music Roundup and joins us to talk about a few of those songs. You can find our previous conversations with Wilde at wuwm.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.